Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm, a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
When someone asks, "Would you like hot sauce with that?" Did you know that you are being offered an ancient food? When was it invented, and where did those peppers come from? We'll find out all about it today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And it seems that in recent years, we've become obsessed with hot sauces and the hottest peppers we can find. And also, it seems that hot sauce is as ubiquitous on the table as ketchup. And each of these items are made from what we call New World foods, chilies, tomatoes, and there's so many other of the New World foods like that that have really changed the cuisines around the world. Harissa, piri piri, sambal, sriracha, no matter what you call it, every time we reach for the hot sauce, there is for sure a story of botanical evolution and development of the peppers that are within the bottle. So to find out more about these stories, I went to the source, the Pope of Peppers, as he is called by some, Dave DeWitt. Dave is a culinary historian and an author, quite an author, prolific author, who has written more than 30 books and started two magazines all about hot foods, hot peppers and spices. But he's branched out as well in food history and micro-farming. Some of the books that Dave has written are Fiery Cuisine, the whole chili pepper book, the Hot Sauce Bible, Chili Pepper Encyclopedia, the Spicy Food Lover's Bible, Habanero Cookbook, and the Complete Chili Pepper Book. You get the point? He's written a lot of books about hot and spicy food. And one of the books that I have found particularly interesting, one of his more recent books, he wrote Da Vinci's Kitchen, which was more on branching out into other foods and how they developed international cuisines. And in 2014, a book that won the IACP Award for Culinary History is his book, Precious Cargo, How Foods from the Americas Changed the World. That I have found extremely interesting, and that led me to do this show. And Dave, welcome. He's joining me today on the line from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hi, Linda.
Of course, New Mexico. Where else? He's a pepper guy. which was first, your love of peppers or living in New Mexico?
They were simultaneous. What happened was I came out to New Mexico on a vacation in July of 1974 and moved here in November. Just decided to change my style. I'd never been west of the Mississippi before in my life, and I found New Mexico to be a completely intriguing place. And so I decided to start my freelance writing career and just have a new life in the West.
Wow.
So I've been here ever since, and I started writing about, you know, New Mexico food and travel, and you can't really write about New Mexico food without writing about chili peppers, since they're so dominant in our cuisine here.
Absolutely. Well, what I have failed to mention is that you've, of course, had other lives as well. You were a radio and TV producer and announcer. You also, well, in addition to the books, the Complete Chili Pepper book is very interesting. You co-authored that with Dr. Boslin, a chili pepper breeder from New Mexico State, right? And also you You made the, along with New Mexico State University Media Arts Department, the first video documentary on chili peppers. Heat Up Your Life?
Yes, it's a three-part documentary, nearly 3 hours long, and we shot in locations in Jamaica and Mexico and New Mexico and Texas, and we had a great time doing that. And we tried to document how chili peppers have affected people's lives in more ways than just food, but particularly in food. And New Mexico was at one time the largest producer of chili peppers. We've been eclipsed a little bit by California now, but we still grow a lot of chili peppers in New Mexico, and of course, because of NAFTA and so forth, the New Mexican varieties are also grown in Mexico, specifically in Chihuahua.
Right.
So we have a lot of imported chilies, but they're all the same variety, so you wouldn't notice any change in flavor or anything like that.
Well, and right near you, don't they have the annual jalapeno roasting festival?
Well, they have the chili roasting festivals in a lot of different places now. Mostly New Mexico chilies rather than jalapenos. Jalapenos don't really need to be roasted and peeled, but the New Mexico varieties have a very tough skin, and the importance of removing that skin before you try to eat them, especially if you're going to say stuff them, it'd be very unpalatable to have that tough skin on. So we roast them in cylindrical drums, and then remove the skins, and it makes for a much better tasting chili because of the roasting. Of course, caramelizes the sugars and so forth like that, and makes them extremely tasty. And then you can chop them up, make green chili stew, or make an enchilada sauce or whatever. And we also let the chilies turn red and harvest them, so we have either red or green, which is our state question, red or green.
Huh.
We have to have a state question. Of course, we have two state vegetables, neither of which is a vegetable. We have chili peppers, they're fruits, and we have pinto beans, and of course, they're legumes. So the wise legislature made us have two state vegetables, and neither one is a vegetable. So go figure.
Well, you know, that's your pulling the wool over the population's eyes, or pulling the pepper over their eyes. You know, you also are the founding producer of the Fiery Foods and Barbecue Show, which is a huge trade show that you've done for, what, over 25 years now?
Well, yes, we're in our 29th year now. That'll be next March. I think it's 4, 5, 6. I have to look it up. I can't remember from year to year after doing it for 28 years. And it's the largest trade show and consumer show related to chili peppers and hot and spicy foods. I'm talking about now a trade show inside. I'm not talking about large festivals where chilies are just an excuse to party. I'm talking about a serious trade show. We don't have, you know, face painting and chili eating contests or anything like that. This is business, and the wholesale part of it is of course the manufacturers selling in bulk to places like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and different supermarkets and other smaller retail operations, and then we are open to the general public, and people want to come and taste the new products and of course buy them, because not every product is available in every city, as you probably know. And so they get a lot of new stuff. They're very interested in trying that. And it brings out, you know, anywhere between 15 and 20,000 people, depending on the weather, depending on
right.
what other things are going on and so forth. So,
kind of like the fancy food show of peppers, right?
Well, it is. It's not nearly as large as the fancy food show. But in terms of chili peppers, it's pretty diverse. We divide the hot and spicy foods into about 60 plus different categories, and the largest portion of that being snack foods, in the sense of the largest number, because if you count chips differently from, say, popcorn, then you get an enormous number of snack foods which now have chili peppers in them. The jerky would be a perfect example of a type of you know, snack food that did not have chili peppers until, oh, maybe 20 years ago or something like that. Mm. Ketchup being another one, that's more of a condiment, but there's probably 20-some hot and spicy ketchups. When the ketchup manufacturers noticed that people were putting hot sauce into their ketchup, and why bother if you can make a hot and spicy ketchup that
that's
will,
right.
you know, automatically spice up your hamburger or whatever. So
we
love these hot and spicy products, and we also have a contest that's in its 20th year called the Scoville Awards, named after Wilbur Scoville, who developed the first chili pepper heat scale. And we have, you know, about 800 to 1,000 products from around the world entered into this contest that has 60 food categories anyway. So that's a big deal as well, and it just shows the dimension of hot and spicy foods and how much they are influencing our lives and people, and turning people into chili heads, if you want to view it that way. This is not to say that people who like hot and spicy eat hot and spicy every single meal of the day. I do not. I like all kinds of full-flavored foods. I like Italian cuisine in particular. And so now Italian cuisine is getting spiced up. Going
That's
to Italy
right.
now, you can get all kinds of spiced up Italian food. So
That's right.
It's going everywhere. People don't think of France being hot and spicy, but they have an Espelette Pepper Festival every year in the southern part of France where they grow, you know, these protected varieties of peppers. And it goes on and on and on, as you saw probably in my book, Precious Cargo. And in countries all over the world are growing new world crops very, very successfully. And new world crops such as potatoes and sweet potatoes have prevented famine in certain areas in certain parts of history. And that is good for everybody. As people find out, oh my gosh, you know, vanilla is an American food. Chocolate's an American food. It goes on and on.
Right.
Potatoes, tomatoes, the whole solanaceous plants are mostly from, you know, the New
the
World.
Americas,
speaking
right.
about North and South and Central America.
Right. Well, you mentioned other countries growing some of these foods that were, you know, originally grown in the Americas, chili peppers, of course, being one of them. And the Wall Street Journal recently had an article about, I guess it was about Wilbur Scoville and talking about the, you know, the graph and the heat scale, and also mentioned that the U.S. production of chili peppers has fallen in recent years, but the imports have climbed from about 200,000 pounds to almost 2 million pounds of peppers every year that we're importing from other countries. That's amazing. That's a lot
of
pepper.
Well, we're importing the dried chilies a lot from India, especially the cayenne varieties. And then the largest producer of fresh chilies is China. Also, China is the largest producer of fresh tomatoes in the world now. And I think you can see they just have a lot of people growing stuff.
Right, right. back to Scoville, I'm sure most people are familiar with that being a heat scale, but maybe not. That describe the heat scale, the Scoville units, to us from.
Okay, well, the original one, Wilbur Scoville, he worked for Parke Davis, the pharmaceutical company, and they were manufacturing a topical cream called Heat, H-E-E-T, and that was for arthritis pain and that sort of thing. And the big problem with making that particular cream was that you didn't know how hot the chilies were. So, I mean, chilies, when they're, you know, very, very hot, have a lot of capsaicin in them, can cause, you know, burning on the skin and so forth, and even blistering. And then, of course, if you have a very, if a cream doesn't have very much of that in it, it's not going to be effective. So he tried to figure out a way and succeeded in figuring out a way to at least get a ballpark estimate of the heat of a chili pepper. And he did that by dilution. In other words, if he had to dilute the pepper 100 to 1, then it had a heat scale of 100. If 1,000 to 1, it had a heat scale of 1,000 Scoville heat units, named after himself. And this was a human taste test, so there's going to be all kinds of errors in this because everybody has a different tolerance for the heat level. But still, it was a start. And now, of course, we use scientific methods. Chromatography is the main way, where they find the amount of capsaicin in parts per million, and then they do still convert it into Scoville heat scale because that's what the food industry uses to measure the heat. And so it's done, of course, scientifically now, but still, Scoville made a it was breakthrough science in 1912. This kind of thing was breakthrough technology.
Absolutely.
And he did it, and we should be happy for him. And you know, the nobody knows very much about Wilbur Scoville. I tracked it down and wrote a professional short biography, which is posted on my website, fierycentral.com. And it was interesting because we know nothing about his personal life other than he was married and had a couple of kids. But we don't know, nothing was ever written that I can find about his personal life. But his professional life, he was very successful. And I don't think he believed that he would be famous for his Scoville organoleptic test. That means tasting, by the way, organoleptic, just a scientific word meaning tasting. But we revere him, probably the first chili-head geek who ever lived.
Well, in 1912, you're absolutely right. I mean, you couldn't even find many bottles of hot sauce on the shelf in 1912. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the early history of peppers, of chilies, and chili hot sauces. Where did it all start?
It all started probably in the greater Amazon basin. Chili peppers are very, very old crops, not only wild, but very old domesticated crops, too. And scientists now believe, after archaeological discoveries, that chili peppers were first used as tolerated weeds. In other words, they grew around and people didn't cultivate them, but they picked the pods and used them, probably in hot sauces. And the reason we say they probably used in hot sauces, they found residues of chili peppers in pots dating back a couple of thousand years. So, and they were not chilies and chocolate. We hear a lot about the Aztecs and chilies and chocolate. That is true. And they found, of course, pots that have both of them in there. But it wasn't known until later on that they were also just used as a condiment. And there's nothing else with the chilies that they found. It's just chili remnants. So the primitive hot sauces of the Indians of say, the Amazon basin were just crushed up chili peppers mixed with probably water. Mm. They didn't have much else. There was no oil, so to speak, to mix them with to make a dressing or something like that. So it was probably just chilies and water, and they were used to spice up bland root crops like manioc, which was a big crop, of course, which is spread around the world like other New World crops. Mm-hmm. And so that's so bland, and potatoes also in Peru were so bland that they needed something. They needed something to make them flavorful, and chilies were there and they're and available. And of course, the dawn of agriculture, when people started actually growing things purposely rather than harvesting them in the wild, they became farmers instead of gatherers. I'm sure there was still some gathering going on, but there was an eruption about 400 A.D. And in the little village near Sarin, and a volcano covered that village completely in ash. It's sort of the American Pompeii. And when they dug through the ash, they found chili fields, that they actually had chili fields, and they found pots that had chili seeds next to pots that had chocolate pods in them. So the association with chilies and chocolate side by side on the shelf, so to speak, was a further clue. And it also proved that the stories that the Spanish explorers told about chilies were probably true. Because when they first came to the New World in the 1600s, the early 1600s, they found and described the chilies in the markets in Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City. And they described the smoked chilies, the long chilies, yellow chilies, and all these that were used for specific foods. And so they, you know, these early Indians, I'm saying Indians, Native Americans or whatever, in the in Mexico in particular, had already developed all these varieties, some of which we know today, like, for example, smoked chilies, chipotles, we call them now. They were described as red, elongated pods that were put on like primitive grills and smoked until they were dried. So that you know, has lived on for a long time. We're talking about 400 or 500 years that we know that these particular chilies were around.
Right.
But I found that when I traced the history of these foods going around the world, almost the first thing you find in every cuisine is some sort of hot sauce. And the hot sauces vary enormously from country to country because they include the spices and herbs that are native to those particular places. So,
right. Well, we're going to talk more about some of those spices when we come back from a break. But what I wanted to make clear was that as far as cultivation of the peppers, so you would place that about when did they actually cultivate these? You mentioned that they were wild 2,000 years ago.
I think it was about 2,000 years ago. Some people say 5,000 years ago based on some seeds that were found in archaeological digs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a big debate. Nobody really knows for sure.
So certainly when the Spanish conquerors came in the 16th century, it was a well-established,
yes,
cultivated
absolutely
crop. Okay. And a very important crop, obviously, to their diet, as you've told us. So when we come back after a short break, we're going to talk about some of these other cuisines and their sauces. So stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm. Consider Bardwell Farm is a sustainable pasture-based dairy farm, making award-winning raw cow and goat's milk cheeses in a not-too-far corner of Vermont. For Consider Bardwell, sustainability means caring for the land, raising their animals well, reducing waste, and helping their community, all in the name of happy animals and people and delicious cheeses. Consider Bardwell Farm is proud to support Heritage Radio Network as part of their food and farming community and a proud sponsor of all good conversations had over great cheese. Find them at your local cheese counter, at New York City Green Markets, and online at ConsiderBardwellFarm.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Dave DeWitt, the Pope of Peppers, all about the history of chili peppers and hot sauces. So you were talking, Dave, about so many of these other cuisines around the world that adopted chilies into their diet, into their cuisines. And, of course, everyone has a hot sauce, right?
You know, they all do. And I wrote a book a few years ago with my friend Chuck Evans, who has a hot sauce company. And as we trace the spread of hot sauces around the world, we found, you know, such varying kinds of hot sauces. Like, for example, the Katjang in Indonesia. It's a peanut chili sauce. And the number of hot sauces in Africa is astounding. We know that, for example, chili peppers conquered a country, that would be Hungary, and another country, that would be India. But in the case of Africa, chili peppers conquered an entire continent. Africa is just unbelievable. And, of course, Malaysia and Indonesia are also unbelievable. I went to Johor Bahru in Indonesia and went to a supermarket, and it looked exactly like an American supermarket. They had the wide aisles and the high shelving and all that kind of stuff. Three entire aisles filled with nothing but hot sauces and chili paste. It was mind-boggling to see that. I mean, how does anybody make a decision?
Right.
we think of sriracha and we think, oh, that's the Asian sauce of choice. But when you look at all the variety, it was, you know, unbelievable. And the I found everywhere it seems like I go in the world, you can find their version of a hot sauce or their version of something hot and spicy that people are putting on their food. And it's the peri peri pepper in South Africa, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little piquin type chili related to Tabasco. And I made the mistake of going to a Nando's chicken restaurant and ordering. The server asked me, do you want it mild, medium, or hot? And, of course, I said hot. And it was so hot I couldn't even eat it.
And that's you we're talking about.
Well, everybody thinks I can eat all this super hot stuff and so forth, but I'm just like anybody else. I like my food medium hot, and that's it. I can't take the super hot stuff. And so, embarrassed, I had to send it back. Mm. But I praised him, saying, boy, you guys know how to make it hot. And, you know, this is a restaurant chain devoted to hot and spicy chicken that has 800 locations, mostly in Asia and Africa. So it's, you know, mind-boggling to me how far the hot and spicy movement has spread around the world. And it starts with hot sauces, but then there's an entire sophisticated level of foods. For example, in Thailand, the number of dishes that are hot and spicy is almost uncountable. In India, I found that they were the restaurants and so forth were seeing our faces and hearing our accents and knowing we were Americans. Actually, we were Americans with a bunch of Brits on a culinary tour, and they deliberately made the food as mild as they possibly could. And we're like, wait a minute, we came to India to eat hot and spicy. Could you give us some authentic food? And they finally got the message that we could take the hot stuff, but of course they were being nice. They didn't want to burn us out. And we find that from Trinidad to South Africa to India to everywhere, when they realize we're Americans, they think, oh, we can't feed them this. They're going to really have trouble with it.
But you'll find that's true even in America. When you go into an ethnic restaurant, you know.
It happens when say, people from the East come to Santa Fe or Albuquerque and so forth like that, and they're directed toward the milder the foods, mm-hmm. just in case.
Mm-hmm.
You can always spice something up, but it's very difficult to take the heat out of something.
Right. So, well, sometimes the hot sauces and the spice mixtures have the same name, I've noticed as well. And I know there was this young Ethiopian cook, and she said, before you can even think of assembling any other ingredients, you have to have your beriberi, because that is your beriberi, because that is the most important ingredient in any Ethiopian dish. And so she was obviously referring to the spice mixture and the peppers, and not a sauce necessarily. But yet you can go in other places and it'll be a sauce, right?
Yes. And of course, the definition of sauce is quite broad. Anything from a thick paste to a really runny liquid still falls into the category of hot sauce. So a salsa is a hot sauce in the sense of, you know, hot sauce in the most generic term.
Right. Well, we can't talk about hot sauces without talking about the history of Tabasco and the McElhinney family. Can we go into that just a little bit and sort of talk about the history and the myth of who invented it?
Well, Tabasco was the first, not the only American hot sauce, but the first American hot sauce to hit it big.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened mostly through food service, believe it or not. And, of course, there were retailers of Tabasco sauce, but the McElhinneys were very, very smart. They knew if they had a bottle of Tabasco sauce on every restaurant table in the United States, they would make a lot of money, and that's you know what happened. And if you go to virtually any place in the world and ask for hot sauce, Tabasco was going to make its appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And Tabasco was an extremely simple sauce to make. It's got water, it's got Tabasco chilies, it's got salt, and that's it. And it has vinegar, of course, the vinegar being the base of it, but vinegar is just, you know, more water with flavoring. And so this is a very easy sauce to make. It used to be cured for 3 years in oaken barrels. I doubt that that's true any longer. I think it is aged, but there's not that many oaken barrels around. They were whiskey barrels that they were being aged in. I've seen that process, and it still happens. I'm not sure it happens with every bottle of Tabasco any longer. I don't really know, but it became so dominant that we've actually discovered the oldest bottle of hot sauce, Tabasco sauce, that anybody's found is more than, I think it's about 130 years old, and it came from a bar in Nevada, and it was all in pieces, and they put it back together and found the Tabasco stamp on the bottom of the bottle. It's sort of interesting from a historical standpoint that there were people people taking shots of hot sauce along with shots of their whiskey.
So when did the company, do you know exactly when? I had that history amongst my notes at one point, but the Tabasco company started, the McElhaney.
It was right after the Civil War, so it was about 1866 to 1868, something like that. I don't exactly know when they went to full-term production, but that was the earliest that I've seen the reports of it in newspapers and so forth from Louisiana.
Interesting. And then where did they ultimately set up in Texas, I think, didn't they?
Well, they're distributed everywhere, but their primary manufacturing facility is still Avery Island in Louisiana.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because it says it on the bottle, so I just wanted to make sure that they were telling the truth.
It may be made in other places now. I'm not sure, but Texas was famous for its Pace Picante sauce, which is now manufactured by Campbell Soup.
Oh, Well, I mean, there are so many brands. You talk about three aisles in the supermarket in Indonesia. But, I mean, even here you can go into some of the ethnic grocery stores and just find, you know, shelves, complete shelves and like half an aisle devoted to hot sauces. It's pretty amazing.
It is.
To what do you attribute this rise in popularity? Anything
well,
in particular?
It's this thing that happens to people who get accustomed to hot and spicy food, and I've never heard anybody in my entire life say, oh, I used to eat hot and spicy, but now I'm back to bland. It doesn't go in that direction. It goes the opposite direction. People like it. They want to eat it. They find the heat level that satisfies them. They want to stick with that heat level, and they like certain kinds of foods. This is not to say they dump hot sauce on their breakfast cereal in the morning or put it in their coffee, but they might like to have huevos rancheros in the morning, spicy eggs, for example. They might want to mix a hot sauce into their scrambled eggs too, because the eggs are bland. And I'm not saying that's the only thing that they would use, but it's very common and very easy and very inexpensive to do this, and now we're seeing a wider variety of sauces, like the sriracha sauce coming on, the Cholula from Mexico, which is an excellent sauce for restaurants and so forth.
Yeah. And let's. I want to return to some of the other international cuisines that really have adopted the hot sauces and the chilies as you know, they're not a primary ingredient, but as a main ingredient for a lot of their dishes. And I'm thinking of the Chinese. I mean, they have their Daoban sauce and so many other, you know, garlic and chili sauces. They're cooking, well, certain regions, southern regions, are people say, oh, I don't want to eat that kind of food. It's too hot and spicy.
Well, it's just a taste level, and you know, people associate this with taste buds, but taste buds, they just register, the sour, sweet, bitter, umami, and those kinds of senses. But we have also capsaicin receptors in our mouth and tongue that we co-evolved with chili peppers, and that's why capsaicin affects us. And so the level of our liking of hot and spicy has to do with genetics. It has to do with how many capsaicin receptors. If we have a whole bunch of them, then we can't take anything hot. If we have fewer of them, then we can take even super hot chilies for some people can do that. So that's what's driving this whole liking of hot and spicy. And people can adapt a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and curries, you had mentioned in Precious Cargo, you talked about curries and how... Of course, curry spread. That's a whole other story, and that's a whole other show about curries. But as you had mentioned, the further east you go, the hotter the curry becomes.
Right.
And that's just when you get into far India. Just tell me a little bit why. What in particular?
Well, the Bhutjolokia, the super hot chili, was grown in Nagaland after being imported from the Caribbean, because all the super hot chilies developed in Trinidad through a mutation that happened to chilies that were being grown there already. And we tracked how that particular pepper got there. And so the people who are making curries in Nagaland, they're about probably 10 times to 20 times hotter than the usual curries you would find in the rest of India, because they're using these super hot chilies, and they have adapted somehow to actually being able to eat these things and find it palatable when most people it would be too hot and they could not even get through a teaspoon of it.
Right. So I guess developing a sauce is a nice way to tighter the use of the hot chili, right? Get a little drop or two rather than eating a half a pepper. But then you mentioned earlier in the show Hungary and paprika. Talk a little bit about that, because you don't see bottles of paprika sauce.
No, you don't.
And it's not hot and spicy.
It's a dried powder, but when you're making chicken paprikash and so forth like that, you use the powder, the paprika, as a powder, but it becomes a sauce in the mixture. So when you see the finished dish, it looks like a sauce has been put on it, when really it's the juice from the chicken and water and the other flavorings that would go into chicken paprikash that make it that way. And you know, in the United States, paprika is any non-pungent red chili powder. I'm saying chili or pepper powder, if you want to put it that way. And that's not true in Hungary. There's 22 different kinds of paprikas in Hungary, ranging from blisteringly hot to no heat whatsoever. And they use these in different foods for different effects and so forth. So what we know of paprika is completely different in Hungary, with a variety of heat scales and heat levels. And, of course, it's undoubtedly the national spice of Hungary, but it really is part of their entire cuisine. And that's what I mentioned, that there's an example of chili peppers taking over a country. And in Africa, it's taken over a continent, literally every single country in Africa, and there's 105 of them or something, is hot and spicy cuisine.
Mm-hmm. And as far as a sauce, as far as table sauce, how customary or even prevalent is in some of these African, throughout Africa? I mean, I think of harissa. Well, you would use it in making the dish, but not necessarily. Well, yeah, that's not true. There's a bowl. You can have a bowl of it on the table.
Yeah.
But how prevalent is the use of a pepper sauce, a chili sauce, on the table?
You know, most of these places, they have some commercial hot sauces, but a lot of times they're just homemade or restaurant made or whatever, and placed on the table with a little spoon for you to use.
Mm-hmm.
You find both in the United States, but the bottled hot sauces are more common. But in New Mexico, you can be served a red chili sauce or a green chili sauce on the side to add as you like to your particular food. Like, you can have enchiladas and with a side of red chili to put over them to the degree that you want to spice it up, and that's a nice thing to have. There's all kinds of hot sauces in England now, and in the Sainsbury stores and all that. You'll find it just like going to a Safeway here in the United States, with the different kinds of, and a lot of those are curry related, of course, because there's, 12,000 curry restaurants in the UK, something like that now. I'm
right.
Not kidding.
No, I know. You're absolutely right. Okay, so as we wrap up the show here, dare I ask what your favorite hot sauce is?
Well, my favorite bottled hot sauce is called Trinidad Pepper Sauce, and it's made with herbs specific to the island of Trinidad. Not to say they don't grow someplace else, but they're grown specifically for the purposes of making sauce, and these are succulent plants that are called thyme, but they're really not thyme. The sauce is manufactured, I think, in New Jersey or someplace on the East Coast, using mash and other ingredients that are produced in Trinidad. And since I've been to Trinidad twice and I love their cuisine, the mixture of Chinese, East Indian, African peoples, And of course, Brits, too, is a fascinating place. And so that's my favorite one at the moment. As far as a sauce for food that's mixed in with the food, I have to say that red chili sauce from New Mexico would be my favorite of that kind. And, of course, that comes in jars, too.
Can use as much as you want. Well, it's interesting because even, and you mentioned the sauce from Trinidad. In the Caribbean, where peppers were wild originally, right? Some of that there. A lot of, you go to individual restaurants and they start, it seems like they realize the craze and are cashing in on it, bottling their own sauce that a chef made in the kitchen. But a lot of these, I found, often have a sugar base. They're sweet.
Yeah, some of them are sweet, yes. A lot of them have a fruit base or a vegetable base like carrots that go well with the habanero chilies and that sort of thing. The earliest habanero sauces had a carrot base. But you can also use mango, you can use papaya, you can use tropical fruits of just about any kind for that particular base. What you don't want is just pure chilies, because these are very, very hot chilies and they'd be unpalatable. So with a base of a... say a sympathetic ingredient, sympathetic chili peppers in the sense it mixes well with them. The fruits and vegetables form the basis of the sauce, and then the chilies are added to establish whatever heat levels. And usually they're hot, but some are medium too.
Yeah, and I'm you know, of course I'm an easy target for those things, so I'll always bring a bottle home, and a couple of them were so hot. I think I've had it for a couple of years now in the refrigerator with only about a quarter of the bottle gone.
That has happened to me, yes.
All right, indeed. Well, this has been truly an education in hot sauces. So the next time that waitress says, "Do you want some hot sauce with that?" think about it, and you'll think about where those peppers come from. Dave DeWitt, thank you very much for sharing your information and your time with us on...
It was wonderful talking to you.
Great. On A Taste of the Past, and please... join us again.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.